leaden winter would bring you down forever. But you rode upon a steamer to the violence of the sun. And the colors of the sea bind your eyes with trembling mermaids, and you touch the distant beaches with tales of brave Ulysses, how his naked ears were tortured by the sirens sweetly singing, for the sparkling waves are calling you.
Hi, this is John Amundson, and I want to welcome you to the next podcast in our series of podcasts presented by the Psychologist Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information that is timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership, and apparently increasingly provide me with an opportunity to walk down memory lane. This particular song and the memory associated is a bar in a tropical coastal town in Nayarit, Mexico, and we're in between surfing sets, and this album was playing. All right, that said, enough. Wake up, tune in. I wanted to speak today a little bit about this idea of when people say, I've done my research, I've investigated that, whether that's us or really more those individuals that are part of the general public. And I'm going to use two examples of what we ought to think about when someone says, I've done my research. Many years ago, I heard a psychologist being interviewed on the CBC, and she was talking about a particular topic. And she said, well, in my research, this person was a clinician, and they were talking about a particular topic, and they were trying to suggest that they had done a comprehensive investigation of the phenomenon at issue. And clearly they hadn't. And we would say to them, your research. A friend of mine is a neurologist in British Columbia, and she posted on her Facebook page a response that she has when her patients or someone in the community says, I've done my research. She says, well, who provided the funding? And who did your ethical review? How many subjects were involved? Was it an open registered clinical research project review? And has it been replicated? Where was your research published? Now, we have something that we can say as well. And I'm looking at, I get Medscape, and I get Medscape Psychiatry as one of my sources for material for the podcast. So what we're looking at is a really sweet little article that was done by a guy from Germany. And he was commenting on a paper that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, on a randomized placebo-controlled study with 20,000 patients investigating omega-3 unsaturated fatty acids and their impact on depression. And he was saying that the results of the trial were negative. Now, that's important in and of itself, because many times our patients are either seeking complementary and alternative medical treatments, or they're asking us about them, or they're making claims for them. And this is one that's been around a long time, omega-3 and its utility for depression. And so he thought he'd do some research, and that's what has spurred this commentary that's taking place, this stuff that I'm doing, eh? He says, first I performed a literature search on Medline, and there were 33,000 papers on omega-3 unsaturated acid supplement with different diseases. And then he went through the scope of those, and he found that it was beneficial with cardiovascular disease, lipid disorders, type 2 diabetes, cancer, for chemotherapy. He looked at its role in what we've already talked about, where it's been shown not to have a function. heart failure, lumbar disc, arthritis, periodontist, retinopathy, anyway, on and on and on. And then he broke it down to look at where it has a main effect. And he said, there seems to be no benefit for heart attacks or TIAs, transient ischemic attacks. I'm not going to go through all the particular diseases, but again, saying he found there was very little support for its use in depression. Now, I think I've already said this, and I'll say it one more time, then we'll get on to the next topic today, and that is this guy looked at a considerable literature before he made any comments about the role of omega-3s in medical treatment. And so we want to think of that too in our own work. What we have is often those of us who have done, say, forensic work, we want to sit on a little fence and watch what comes by and grab it. And we grab ideas that have utility for the particular purposes to which we will put them. So if a study comes out that shows there is some change in brain structure related to EMDR, people immediately will say, you know, it's been shown that this radically alters the way your brain functions. As opposed to the 30,000 studies that relate to omega-3 in a variety of areas. See, brain changes in relation to what? What was EMDR treating? What was the focus in the treatment? Was it post-traumatic? Was it depression? Was it panic? You see where I'm going with this, right? So we need to understand that we're often a bit of an immature science when it comes to these issues, and there are tons and tons of reasons for that. Doesn't mean we don't go forward with a degree of enthusiasm relative to the methods we employ, but we must ask those methods to be less the product of passion and commitment than having stood the test of time. All right, so next topic. Staying with this topic of sort of a relevant habits of thought, there was a really neat article that was popular press on the American Psychological Association's quest to right its past racial wrongs. And, you know, I've been hard on the APA relative to the torture issue, and I've beat that drum now for 8 years, probably 8 years, and have written about it in symposium, speaking about, you know, the ethics of what took place with that. So therefore, you know, it's all right for me to also maybe speak of some nice stuff about APA. I've talked about this in other podcasts, and that is that in the 1960s, the Clarks, Kenneth and Mamie Clark, did some research on black children and their internalized sentiment and their internalized self appraisal and the negative self appraisal, especially associated with their sense of being black. Was published then, and it opened a door for all sorts of consideration relative to the relationship between the dominant culture and Afro-American culture, and especially in such areas as education, leading to reappraisal of Brown versus the Board of Education, which was the support of separate but equal facilities. Anyway, so coming forward, the long time between their research in the 60s and into the 70s and the resolution calling for a range of policy changes today, you know, has to be acknowledged, as well as the resolution calling for these changes. These are recognized as being extensive. They want to look at expanding research relative to public policy in issues of race, and not just Afro-American race, but the ideal Asian sort of stereotype, Polynesian, Pacific culture folks, all Mexican-American, Native American, all of that. They want to look at scientific methodology, and they want to look at formal psychometric assessment, and they want to look at the role of psychologists in being able to assist the larger social system in addressing these inequalities. And we could go through the whole list from children through adults, the differential outcomes related to visible minorities in the United States, especially to Afro-Americans and Black Americans. So the APA, there was an apology that took place in October, and then this whole change in the emphasis and focus that they're undertaking. I do continuous education projects, assignments through APA. You buy a book, you look at the book, you take a test online in any one of a variety of areas. And so I do that. And now each one of these has an attentive focus upon diversity. And when they ask you to evaluate the course and the questions, it will ask, did this speak to diversity in a way that you think was useful? So praise for the APA, as opposed to me beating a drum about how they cooperated with the federal government relative to, what are they called? Enhanced interrogation or something. Okay. And I'm going to cover an article that Mark Ross forwarded to me. And where was it published? Space.com or something. And it was looking at brain changes, structural brain changes in cosmonauts. So what they're finding is there's an actual structural rewiring and changing in the brain of astronauts, cosmonauts, those folks that have been in space. They had to be in space, they were on space on average 172 days. So it was a considerable amount of time in space. What they found, and they were using, scanned the brains in the traditional ways, MRI and that sort of stuff. But they're also using fiber tractography, which looks at an actual wiring in the brain. And so what they found was there were changes midbrain around the corpus callosum, and then but they found changes in several motor areas of the brain. And I think this has to do with weightlessness because the motor cortex and the motor areas have to do with movement. And they found that these show signs of adaptation after spaceflight, and that they're actually changed there. This is exciting, they say, because there's a growing amount of research on artificial gravity and changes neuroanatomically that result from space flight. So that's kind of interesting stuff. I don't know the numbers, maybe I can find that. Yeah, 12. They had 12 male cosmonauts. So after we have maybe 1,200, we'll do what we did in my comments in the very first part of this podcast, and we'll know more precisely what changes, and then maybe the long-term consequences or benefits of such. And then realize it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Woke up this morning, I was feeling quite weird. Had flies in my